Okay, so about, this goes back a ways, about, I don't even know, close to 25 years ago, okay. Definitely more than 20, well, 25 years ago, maybe it was more, I don't even know. It was a couple of days before Purim, and I had never lain the Megillah before at that point. And I read through it, you know, just learning it, whatever, but say, like 2 days before Purim, I find out that all of a sudden there are these people who need someone to lay the Megillah for them, like these emergency cases that popped up. Ended up, by the time we were done, it was four of them. Okay, four different people in four different places needed. As a 90-year-old man who was more than 90, whatever, but something like that, who broke his hip or something and couldn't, you know, leave home. All kinds of things like that that all happened within a short span of time. And I suddenly found out that I was going to lay in the Megillah in like a couple of days, which is a very exciting thing to find out when you've never laid in the Megillah before. So, obviously, I spent a long time going over the Pesukim of Megillah again and again, trying to. I didn't have any hope that I was going to do a really good job, but at least I'd be familiar with it and try to do a, you know, passable job. But it wasn't like, what can you do? This person was not going to hear the Megillah otherwise, you know, and things like that. So while I was going over the Megillah, there was one pasuk, which you've just learned, which really bothered me, which really struck me, and I wanted to understand what it means. And what particularly struck me is the phrase "Umalchuta yitain hamelech liruta hatova mimena," right? Where the advisors of Achashverosh suggest to him that he eliminate Vashti, right, and replace her with Reuta hatova mimena, right, with someone better. Get rid of Vashti and replace it with someone better. The Megillah doesn't actually say in so many words that Vashti was killed, but it's probably a good assumption, right? You know, it's usually how you would get rid of someone from the position of queen. In any case, the point is that Vashti is eliminated, and we move on to Reuta HaTova Mimena. And this phrase, Malchuta Yitein HaMelech Reuta HaTova Mimena, what bothered me about it, basically two things. One is just to understand in what sense better. Okay, tova. Tova in what way? It could be tova in lots of ways. Right? Were they looking for someone who was more beautiful, more intelligent, having a better personality, someone who is more talented, someone who is, would be a better person in politics? All kinds of possibilities, right? What better in what sense? But more than that, what I really want to know is why the authors of the Megillah inserted this phrase, which is essentially lifted, essentially plagiarized, I don't mean that literally, but essentially taken from another Sefer of Tanakh. Where do we know this phrase from? And that's why I gave you a Tanakh, and why I asked you to have a Tanakh instead. Go ahead, what was the Pasuk? What's the context? What are we talking about? Okay. Okay, very good. So now we're ready to start getting out of the sheet. Okay, please take the mask off. Never have to apologize for no.
There you go. Please take the mask off.
Thank you. Okay, we'll wait a second for everyone to get a sheet, and then the extras, you can pass them up here. Anyone not have? All good, thank you. Okay, so now we're going to embark on a very, very, I think, fascinating and important, very, very important journey now. Okay, everyone, let's take a look. Shmuel Aleph, Perek Tet Vav. Vayomer Lav Shmuel, Hara Adonai Mamluchut Yisrael, Me'alecha hayom unitana l're'acha hatov mimecha. Okay, Shmuel Aleph, Perek Tefah, Pasuk Chet, second source on the source sheet, right? And if you look at these two psukim, they're in the first box, side by side, is pretty obvious, except for the change in gender, because in one case we're talking about Shaul and David, in the other case we're talking about Esther and Vashti and Esther, but clearly this is essentially the same statement, right? And we have this relationship which is very, very glaring, and this is what struck me, and I was wondering why, what's that all about? And I'd like to suggest three dimensions, three layers of interpretation, not as alternatives, but as complementing each other, okay? Three levels of understanding this phrase of Malchuta Yiten HaMelech Le'uta Tova Mena in light of its relationship to Sefer Shmuel. Okay? Let's say that. That's what we'd like to do. And see what emerges from that. Let's begin with the following. First of all, from the perspective of the authors of the Megillah, what is it telling us that this is, you know, that's Ruta Tova Mena? In what sense Ruta Tova Mena? And since when we read this Pasuk, immediately we hear the echoes, right? We hear the echoes of the Pasuk in Sefer Shmuel. What does that tell us? So as we're reading through Perek Aleph of the Megillah and the story unfolds and Vashti is going to lose the throne, it's going to be replaced by someone else, but this whole intrigue that leads to Vashti losing her position, what's the significance of that? Why is that important, right? So we're only in Perek Aleph. We've just begun to read the Megillah. We've just begun to read the story. And the authors are telling us, or at least hinting to us, what is the significance of that move? Why are these events important? And the answer is very simple. Because why does Shaul lose the throne? Why does Shaul lose his kingdom? Why does he lose the throne? What did he fail to do? He failed to kill Amalek. And specifically, who did he fail to kill from Amalek? God. And so now what's happening? We have this problem of Haman Ha'agagi, right? This descendant of Agag, the result of Shaul's failure, because Shaul doesn't kill out Agag. So now we have Haman Ha'agagi, who we haven't read about yet here, but right, there's a foreshadowing of what's to come. It gives us a perspective on why this is important. Why is this an element of Hashkacha? Why is it important in the events that are unfolding that Vashti is losing the Malchut and someone else is going to step into her shoes? Why is that important for us? Because just like Shaul fails to get rid of Agag, right, and therefore needs to be replaced with someone better, someone who's going to be Lochei Milcham Tashem, someone who's going to fight against Amalek, so now, the same thing. Vashti is going to be removed so that Esther can step into her shoes, can take over the throne, and thereby deal with the problem of Haman Ha'agagi. Okay? So that's the simplest, most obvious layer of understanding in what sense Tova Mimena, and why it relates to the Psukim in Shmuel. The Seder, right? That's nice and straightforward.
Yeah, but that's nothing to do with that. It's really cool.
What do you mean it has nothing to do with Vashti? I'm saying the way in which it is better that Esther be the queen than Vashti is because of the fact that Esther is going to solve this problem that's caused by Shaul's failure to kill Agag. You know what I'm saying? So that it's the significance of her vacating that position and allowing Esther to become queen is in terms of exactly what's going on in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tefav, the issue of Agag. In our case, Haman Ha'agagi. Am I not being clear?
No.
Okay, good. But that's the first level. Okay, that's level number one. So level number one deals with this relationship and the idea of dealing with Agag, etc. Haman Ha'agagi. But of course, and this brings us to the second level of interpretation, of course, from the perspective of Ahasuerus's ministers, Ahasuerus's advisors, the issue is certainly not one of getting rid of Amalek, right? But rather, they're talking to him, Ruta Tova Mimena, in terms of who would be a better wife, right? And better wife in what sense? So I'd like to examine in terms of both the Psukim and Chazal, in what sense Esther is better than Vashti from the perspective of Ahasuerus and his buddies. Okay, from their point of view. Now, needless to say, the fact that the Megillah is expressing the motivation, right, the intention of these people does not mean, or the fact that I'm explaining it, I don't want you to misunderstand, I'm not saying that I'm sympathetic to Ahasuerus, or the Megillah is sympathetic to Ahasuerus' issues. It's simply telling us what motivated them to do what they did. Right? In the same sense as when the Torah records that Paro says, Hava nitchach malo, and you know, pen your ban, and is describing what motivates Paro. It's not because that's, you know, being given a stamp of approval. It's simply saying that that's why he did what he did. So I'm trying to explain why, what moves them. What are they thinking? So there is a very interesting phenomenon I want to comment on for a second. Interesting psychological phenomenon, which will tie right into the last discussion. Okay. As you'll see in a moment, if you remember what the last discussion was. So I'm not referring to the Bavod Risha Imrina discussion. That was before the last discussion. Anyhow, so the point is that over the years, I've observed something very interesting. And I've had an opportunity to observe it because of the efforts of my wife. And this was always the case, but especially there were 13 years where we lived right next to YU, and this was particularly relevant, but it's true in general. My wife has always been very totally altruistic motives, and just caring for other people, loves to go, if she knows of people who are, you know, not engaged, married, etc., and she, you know, knows a guy, knows a girl, you know, try to go with them and set them up. So she'll go, she would, especially around YU, living in Washington Heights, she would, you know, the guys would see her coming down the block and would run away and, you know, stuff like that. It's a very interesting phenomenon. But that's not the phenomenon I'm talking about. That's not what I meant. But finally she corners someone, right, in some way or other, over the phone or gets them, you know, on the street and say to them, ah, there's this girl, let's say, whatever goes both ways, obviously, but say, you know, oh, there's this person I want you to go out with, and of course, they want to know something about this person. So they'll ask this question and that question, right, whatever it is. And if you were to theoretically, we didn't actually do this, but just in principle, if you were to go and take all the questions that people ask, okay, both boys and girls, all the questions that they ask, you know, before agreeing or not to go out, and you took them and made a composite list and ranked them according to how common the questions were. Like, you know, 50% of people ask this question, so we'll put it on top, and 23% ask this, so we'll put it lower down, and, you know, 2% be all the way on the bottom of the list, etc. And by the way, one of the interesting things you notice is that girls and boys ask different questions. It's a different list, but that's a different discussion. Anyhow, but there is a different list. You know, typical list. There's a different typical list, interestingly enough.
What is it? Yeah, exactly.
That's for another time. Another time. In any case, but it is a different, I don't have the whole list, but I'm saying, but there are differences that are very interesting. In any case, people ask different things, but there's a certain tendency to ask certain things more than others. And then every now and then you get somebody and they ask you this question, the first thing they want to know is like question number 57. And you go like, that's what you want to know? This is the most important thing on your list? That's what you really want to know first? And invariably, the explanation for it is, and this is the interesting phenomenon, the explanation for it is always the same. The last major disaster in the realm of relationships that happened in their life, okay, whether themselves, maybe it was a broken engagement, maybe it was just, you know, they're going out with someone for 5 months and they broke up, whatever it is, the last major disaster of a relationship. It could be something that happened with their brother or sister or their parents, whatever it is. But the last major disaster of a relationship had to do with that particular issue. So for them, that becomes number one, right? Makes sense, right? That's very common. You see this all the time. So there's people who, like, that's the big thing because they feel like that's the thing you really have to worry about. For Achashverosh, and anyone who's trying to, you know, kind of get on his good side and give him, you know, advice that he's going to be happy with, etc., the last disaster for him was, of course, the fact that he ordered Vashti to come to this party, and she didn't come. And he was embarrassed in front of the whole world, right? This was a disaster for him. And that's why he's replacing Vashti with someone else, right? So the fact that Vashti didn't come to that party, that's the biggest issue in the world for Achashverosh, okay? The Gemara says something very interesting about it. It's found in the Midrash as well. It says, Michtei Pritzut and Pritzuta Havai. Vashti was not such a tznua either. The Amar Marshnem and Varveren is Kavnu. So my time alo atai, very famous Gemara, you all know it. So why didn't Vashti come to the party? Amar Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina Melamed Shapir Chabat Sarat, and B'matnita Tana, the Brita says, Ba Gabriel Va'asala Zana. Okay, so we have different opinions why Vashti didn't show up to the party. One opinion is that, and there's, again, as I said, different versions of this, Parchat Sarat B'mitzchah, right, that she got this, you know, we would say that, you know, she broke out, she got this acne, whatever, and she, but whatever it was, she had something that so she didn't look her best that day. That's opinion number one. Opinion number two, the Braita says, Ba Gavriel Va'asala Zanav. Now, what is that? Do you have any friends who have ever had this problem? Is this like a common thing that they sell remedies for in the drugstore? Someone wakes up one morning and they have a zanav and therefore they're not able to go to the party because I have to cancel an important date because I grew a tail last night. This is a little bit odd. So if you look at the Arach, okay, if you look at the Arach, Reinatan of Rome, Reinatan was, Baal HaArach was a contemporary of Rashi. In fact, they corresponded. There are tshuvot between Rashi and the Arach. The Arach is the first great Talmudic dictionary, okay, long before Jastrow and Frank and whoever else he was. But it was much more than that, because it includes important issues of girsaot, it includes important interpretations and explanations, not just translations of words, but in terms of important perushim, okay? Learn Hilchot Shabbat, right? So one of the things that I'm sure you discussed is the Arach Shita about Sikresh Delonichale, right? So, you know, it's not the type of thing you would find in a Jastrow. It's a different type of sefer. It is a dictionary of sorts, but the dictionary includes Perushim of his. He was one of the great Rishonim. And one of the very important things about it is not only his Perushim, which are very important, but he quotes a lot of material from the Gaonim. It's a wealth of material from the Gaonim, from earlier, right, earlier Chachamim. And the Arach says the following. Rashba also says similarly, but Rashba is much later. The Arach says the following pshat. Not specifically talking about this Gemara, but in general, in terms of the word zanav. What does the word zanav mean? Zanav does not mean a tail. In certain contexts, it means a tail, but that's not its primary meaning. That's a particular application of its meaning, right? A zanav is an appendage. A zanav is something that is not part of the basic thing itself. And he gives a bunch of examples. For example, let's say that you have an orchard, okay? And in the orchard, there are rows of trees, okay? And you have rows of trees, and there are, you know, all the trees are in a row, and then there's a tree that's off by itself. That's called Yotzei Zanav. It's not part of the main body of the thing itself. Or let's say that you have a cup, right? You have a cup, and you make a little handle or spout or something, you add something to it, that's called Asala Zanav. And he gives examples all over Mishnayot and so on where this word is used in different senses. But it always means a kind of appendage, something that's extraneous to the basic thing itself. And if we understand that, we understand the beauty of what the Gemara says here. What happened? Vashti, after all, was a very beautiful woman. That's why Achashverosh wanted to invite her. When he had this huge party with, you know, representatives from the whole world and his, all these important people there, he wants to show, the Pesukim say clearly, he wants to show off her beauty. He wants to show, look at this, I have such a beautiful wife. And what happens? Parchat Sarat, meaning that there's something, I don't know exactly what it was. She had a big pimple on her forehead, whatever it is. There was something that she, you know, she didn't look her best that day. And therefore, she didn't want to come. But what does the Gemara add? Ba Gavriel v'Asa Lazanav. Understand, this is something that was extraneous to her. It wasn't something that was part of how she really looked. Again, we're not talking about external and internal beauty or any of those things at this point. That's not the point. We're talking about simply physically. But that when there was something that clouded, something external, something extraneous, something that wasn't part of what she was, even on a physical level, right? Let alone more than that. But even on a physical level, there was something that clouded her beauty. So what happened? I can't go to the party. What's going to happen? People will look at me. They'll think that I'm ugly. I'm not going to go to the party. I'm concerned about how people are going to look at me. They're not going to realize that I'm beautiful, so I'm not going to the party. That was Vashti's reaction. If you look closely at the Pesukim, you'll see how beautifully, and the Midrash picks up on this, but it's clear in the Pesukim. Look at how this is reflected in the selection process and what happens with Esther. Take a look, please, at Perek Bet, Pesukim Yud Bet through Tetvav. You have it right over here in the second box. Uvahagia tor na'ara v'na'ara. And before we go any further, take a look, right after looking at what we just did in Yud Bet, look at the beginning of Pasuk Tetvav. Okay, see how they're parallel, right? They set up a contrast. Uvagia tor na'ara v'na'ara in Pasuk Yud Bet, Pasuk Tetvav, Uvagia tor Esther. See how there's a contrast being set up? And look at the contrast, how it plays up. How it plays out. Uvagia tor na'ara v'na'ara levola melech ha-chashverosh mikei tiyot lakidat ha-nashim. Shneim asar chodesh, kikhein milu yimeim rukehem. Now this is a long time to prepare for a day, right? Shisha ha-chodeshim b'shem ha-namor, b'shisha ha-chodeshim b'bsamim tamrukei ha-nashim. Uvazeh ha-na'ara ba'a el ha-melech. Ekol asher tomar yinatein la-lavo ima. Mi-beit ha-nashim ha-beit ha-melech. Right? Whatever she wanted, anything that she wanted in order to make herself as beautiful as possible when she came before the king, was granted to her. Ba'erev hi va'av, ba'boker hi shava, el beit ha-nashim sheni, el yad shashgaz ris ha-melech, shemer ha-pilag shim, el tavo od el ha-melech, ki'im ha-feitz ba-melech, v'nikra b'shem. That's the description of everyone else. By contrast, look at Pasuk Tetvav. Uvahagia tor Esther bat Avichai dov Mordechai asher lakach lo levat lavo lamelech lo viksha davar. Lo viksha davar. She didn't ask for anything. Right? By everyone else it says kol asher tamar yinatim la lavo ima mi beit hashim beit hamelech. But here, uvahagia tor Esther, etc. Lo viksha Esther. Lo viksha davar. Whatever she was told by the people in charge, but she didn't ask for anything. What's the reaction? Vatihi Esther nos'eit chein be'enei koro'eha. Okay, and she found favor in everyone's eyes. Everyone was so impressed by her. Why is everyone so impressed by her? Because everyone says, what would Esther have done if she were in Vashti's shoes? She's saying, I'm beautiful enough. I don't have to go to any, you know, what they call it, heroic. I don't need to take any, you know, heroic actions to make myself more beautiful. She says, I'm who I am. I'm what I am. I have faith in myself. I don't need to worry about, you know, how people are going to see me. And again, we're talking about here physical beauty. But we're saying that she wasn't, this is the type of person, everyone looks at her and says that this is, and this is shot number two, which I think complements the first one, from the perspective of Achashverosh and his advisors, this was Re'utah Tova Mimena. This is a person who, if what had happened with Vashti had happened with Esther, she would have gone, because she would have said, okay, so you know, if they think I'm not beautiful, that's their problem, it's not my problem. That's level two of understanding what's going on. Re'utah Tova Mimena. But level one and level number two are really not what's important. What's important is level number three. But it's necessary to see number one and two in order to understand number three. Yes?
Didn't we say that what was going on with Vashti, this appendage or whatever it was, that wasn't her normal, beautiful self?
Right.
So it's not necessarily saying that she wasn't happy with who she was. The problem was that she wasn't herself.
Right. What I'm saying, the problem with Vashti is that she was overly concerned about how she would be perceived by everyone else. Whereas Esther is showing that she is not overly concerned with how she's going to be perceived by everyone else. That's the point.
She didn't have a giant hemorrhage on her face.
Right, but I think that, again, obviously this wasn't the same circumstance, but the point is that looking at how, but at the same time, here is this person who is not the queen, who is just has the potential to become the queen, right? Everyone is vying for this position, and she comes before the king, and she's not trying to, you know, go to great efforts to project something beyond. She's simply not, you know, overly concerned about how she's going to be perceived. I think that gives an insight into how she would have reacted in that kind of circumstance. Granted, not the same circumstance. Saying that's what I think the point is here. And therefore, Batia Esther no save chayim b'nei Korach. Okay. So now we're ready to really get started. Level number three. Okay, level number three.
Okay.
Level number three is a synthesis.
What are
these
levels of Esther?
These are levels of Ru'utah Tova Mimena, of understanding the idea of what the relationship between Esther and Vashti is, okay, and this transition. Ready? Here comes number three. This is the key. Why did Shaul not kill Agag and the Meitav Atzon? Why did he not do what God commanded? So there are other explanations that we looked at in terms of Vayar Banachal and all of Chazal, etc. But for a moment, Pshat, why did Shaul not kill them out? So before we get to that, I'll just point out that initially when Shmuel confronts him, as is often the case, his first reaction is... First reaction is to deny that he did anything wrong, right? The first reaction is, why did you do that? Me? I didn't do anything wrong. What do you mean? I didn't do anything. And he says, you know, first thing he says is that I killed that Amalek. I did what God commanded, right? But when he finally admits that he did something wrong, and he says why he did it, okay, so what's the reason? Take a look at Shmuel Aleph, exactly the same thing with Shmuel Aleph, Pek Tet Vav, Pasuk Chaf Dalet. Vayomer Shaul el Shmuel, Chatati ki avarti et pi Adonai bet varecha, ki yareti et ha'am va'ishma b'kolam. What does Shaul say? I was afraid. I was worried about what the people were saying, what the people thought. Whether I was concerned about my approval rating. I was concerned about my approval rating. I was concerned about what the people wanted me to do. This is why Shaul loses the Malchut, because that's not a leader, right? Leader's not someone who says, okay, what's going to be popular, I'm going to do it. Shaul says, Ki areti atam b'shma b'kolam, and therefore, karasha mamluchut yisrael melech hayom atanam b'riachat tov b'riyot. Good, so, Shmuel bet perek vav. We fast forward, and David is king.
Right.
And,
in the street.
What?
In the street. And he says to...
Ah! Yes. Go ahead.
Ah. His wife, she yells at him because he was dancing with them in the street with Jews, and she said that it wasn't befitting for a king.
Exactly.
And he said, I got it from your dad.
So let's look at insights. Unbelievable. Exactly. Look at what happens. Vayashav David levarecha beito vatetzei Michal bat Shaul. Right. Not only the husband. The wife of David, but also the daughter of Shaul. And by the way, if you follow carefully in Shmuel Bet, you see that there is Michal is referred to as Bat Shaul in certain contexts, in other contexts, the wife of David, depending on what's going on. It's very, very
bedavka.
Ah, there we go. Okay, so it's very bedavka. It's Michal Bat Shaul here. Okay. Vayashu David lebrech beito vatetzei Michal Bat Shaul lekrat David. Atomer manichban hayom, melech Yisrael asher nigla hayom leineam hot avadav kikalot niglot achar harekim. Right, you're dancing around here like a commoner. It's so unbefitting of a king. Vayomer David el Michal. And this is so important. Listen very carefully to this response of David. Vayomer David el Michal. Lifnei Adonai asher bachar bi me'avich. L'tzavot oti nagir al am Adonai al Yisrael. V'sichakti lifnei Adonai. What does David answer? Michal, what are you telling me in effect? You're telling me to act like whom? Yeah, like your father, like Shaul. That was Shaul's problem. That's why Amrei Acha told me Mecca. That's why I was chosen to replace Shaul. Because Shaul was worried about what it looked like in the eyes of the people. He was worried about perception. He was worried about what people thought instead of worrying about what was the right thing to do. And that's why he didn't wipe out Amalek, and that's why he lost the Malchut. So that's your great advice to me, Michal, that I should be like your father? In other words, Re'uta, I'm sorry, Re'acha, told me Mecca, in terms of Shaul and David, is about this issue of whether one is concerned with their, with what they are and who they are, what they're doing, what's the right thing or not, or they're concerned about perception and what people think and how people view it. Right? That's the dichotomy of Shaul and David. And of course, in a different realm, right, in a different context, the difference between Shaul and David is essentially the difference between Vashti and Esther. Right? And here's where the different, right, different understandings of Ruth and Vaimena all come in. Okay? Remember the good old analogies? Right? Good old business, right? So we have Vashti and Esther, and we have Shaul and David. Right? The difference that we have in terms, again, that we saw in terms of Shaul and David, Vashti and Esther, this is Re'uta HaTovah. Oh, I can't relate to that. Time for another topic. And Re'acha HaTov Mimecha. Right? This is the difference between them. So, I knew that if I looked, there was no way that there wasn't going to be a midrash, right? It's obviously going to be a chazal. In this case, there are actually two, at least two fascinating chazals. Look at these two chazals. Esther Rabba, Parsha Dalin, Piskatet. Amrei Chanina Bereid Rabbi Aval, Ktiv Ki Hu Yachiv Yachvosh, Yimchatz V'Yadav Tirpena. God wounds, but He also heals. Which Chazal interpret to mean that God uses the same blade to create the wound and to heal it. The same instrument, the same. Balashon shenatla malchut mizkena sha'amar lo Shmuel unetana l'reacha tov mimecha. The same language that's used to remove the malchut from Esther's ancestor from Shaul, Bo Balashon, Chazra lo Hamalchut. The Malchut royalty returns to the house of Shaul, to Esther. As it says, Hadao Dukhtiv, as Pasuk says, Umalchuta Yitain HaMelech, Liruta Tova Mimena. Beautiful idea that when Esther corrects the flaw, Esther's descendant of Shaul, when Esther corrects the flaw of Shaul, then Malchut returns to the household of Shaul. There's another chazal, and this is even more amazing.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Yes. The Midrash says that Hashem used, that the same Lashon is used for the removal of the Malchut, right, from Shaul, by Shmuel. The same language is used to return the Malchut to Shaul's descendant, namely Esther. Pointing out the parallelism between these two languages, But more than that, saying that when Esther, who is the descendant of Shaul, corrected this flaw, right, corrected this character flaw, then Malchut returns to that line. And look at this Gemara in Ketubot. This Gemara in Ketubot is amazing. It's one of those cases where Chazal give an interpretation of a pasuk and make a point about it without ever quoting the pasuk. They do this a lot of times, and it's very rarely noticed. Very often it gets by us. You can really be sensitive to it. It's something that happens all the time. Maybe some other time we'll discuss it, but very common idea, something that happens many times in Tanakh. Ki ata Rav Dimi Amar, hacha mashri kamikalta b'marava. Okay, when Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael to Babel, he said that in Eretz Yisrael they used to sing in front of the Kala the following thing. They would say, lo kal, v'lo srach, v'lo pirchos, v'yalatchem. Right? Without all of these, you know, makeup and hair adornment, nonetheless, v'yalatchem. And she, you know, she finds favor in people's eyes, v'yalatchem. Now, let me ask you for a second. Where does this idea come from of without all kinds of, you know, embellishment of you know, a whole beauty treatment, nonetheless, v'ya'alat chayin, where does that come from? Obviously Esther, right? Esther, lo biksha davar, right? She doesn't ask for any of these things. Fati Esther, no se tchein b'inei koroah, right? This is the story of Esther. And here it's talking about a kala, it's talking about her beauty. Look at the next line. Ki samchu rabbanan l'rabbi Zeira, when they gave smicha to Rabbi Zeira, and here we're not talking about physical beauty anymore. Here we're talking about leadership. When they gave smicha to Rabbi Zeira, shor lehachi, so they sang the following, lo kchal, v'lo srak, v'lo pirchas, v'yalat chen. In other words, the same idea that you have by Esther in one realm, we have in the realm of leadership, in the story of Shaul and David, right, on the other hand. And that's exactly what the Gemara is telling us here. That's Gemara in Ketubot on Daf Yud Zayin. Okay? With me so far? Okay, let's go a step further. So we're not going to do everything on this page, but we do want to do one more thing. One more thing. And then bring it all together. So if you look at Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Yud Bet, Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Yud Bet, the third box on the bottom, you see something very interesting. V'David ben ish Ephrati hazeh mibeit lechem Yudah u'shmo Yishai v'lo shmona banim v'ish b'mei Shaul zakein ba'ab anashim. And it's an old and famous question about this pasuk. Many discuss and there are different approaches to it. I want to share with you what I think is the most obvious answer, although I know other people give other answers, but I think it's like such a clear answer. If you look at this pasuk, it's very strange. What's strange about Pasuk Yud Bet? You're telling me what's strange about this Pasuk. You can't tell me what's strange about the Pasuk, then you can tell me what type of a Pasuk this is. What function does this Pasuk serve? What's it doing?
No. Parentheses, like just telling information.
Tell me information. What kind of information? Okay, so what is it doing in terms of David? When would you have a pasuk like this?
Before.
Okay. In other words, this pasuk is, if you need backup, just call. What? Yeah? Come on, backup. Yes. Okay. So, this pasuk, the nature's pasuk, is it's an introduction, right? It's introducing David. It's telling us who he is, who his father is, he has this many brothers. It's a nice introduction to David. So why is this so strange? You have to look. This is Perek. It's Perek Yud Zayin. Where is David first introduced? In Perek Tet Zayin. And not only is David in Perek Tet Zayin, but we have David, and we have Yishai, and we have David's brothers, right? The whole story of how Shmuel goes, and he's trying to anoint David, right? And he goes, and he thinks that maybe this brother, and then Hashem says to him, no, 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 that's the wrong one, and it's maybe this brother, and then he goes to Yishai and says, maybe there, you know, do you have any, is there anyone left? And says, no, well, it's David, and he's out, you know, he's out tending this flock, and right? So, here, Perek Yud Zayin, the middle of Perek Yud Zayin, we're introducing David. After we've met David, and we've met Yishai, and we've met his brothers, and we're told how many there are. So what's this doing here? So the answer is, and there's a big yesod in Tanakh, the answer is that it always works that way. That every narrative is told from the perspective of a particular person, or it could be a couple, like, you know, Avram and Sarah, Yitzhak and Rivka, but basically a person who is the central character, and everything is in terms of them, right? So everyone else is kind of, you know, like objects, well, that person is the subject. Okay, I'm exaggerating, but that's the basic idea. When someone steps from being a secondary character to being the primary character, they're introduced to us even if we've already met them before as a secondary character. For example, and there are of course many drashim about this, etc., but the simple pshat, ve'ele toldo Yitzhak ben Avraham, Avraham holina Yitzhak. So what's the pasuk saying? Ve'ele toldo Yitzhak ben Avraham, but we've been talking about Yitzhak for a while now already, right? We read about the birth of Yitzhak at great length. The whole story with Sarah and Avram and Yitzhak, and also Ve'ele toldo Yitzhak ben Avraham, and then Avraham holina Yitzhak. Why do we need to be told that? So again, we all know the midrashim. What's the simple pshat in the pasuk? Until now, we're talking about the story of Avram and Sarah, and how Avram and Sarah are old, and nonetheless God blesses them with a child, and v'chule, v'chule. But it's at this point that Yitzhak becomes, right, the Yitzhak steps center stage. The Yitzhak becomes the main character, and so therefore he's introduced to us. The Eila Toldot Yitzhak ben Avraham, and what's the first event that we want to be told if we're now told about Yitzhak? Avraham Olid Yitzhak, that's the most important fundamental fact in Yitzhak's life. Similarly, Perek Tet Zayin talks about David, but not in terms of David. It talks about how Shmuel is given a lesson, and Chazal points out in Mechilta, etc. Shmuel is given a lesson in how to choose a leader, how he should choose the next leader. But that's an event in the life of Shmuel, not in the life of David. When we get to the story of Goliath, then we're already beginning the career of David, and that's why David is introduced here. Now, why do I tell you this? What does that have to do with anything? So I don't expect you to know the answer to this, because it's a little devious, but it's not a direct connection, but it's very important background. But also, I want to just point out the following. In Sefer Shmuel, if you learn Sefer Shmuel, you see that for the first 16 and a half chapters, everything is told from the perspective of whom?
Shmuel
Hanavi. Everything is about Shmuel. When Shaul becomes king, we don't hear about how Shaul feels about it. We hear about how Shmuel feels about it. It's a story of Shmuel. That's the first half of Sefer Shmuel. The second half of Sefer Shmuel is the story of whom?
David.
Second half is David. And what about Shaul? Shaul is always a secondary character. Shaul is never the primary character. Never. He's either there as, you know, a chapter in the life of Shaul, or a chapter in the life of Shmuel, the life of Shmuel, or the life of David. That's it. So now let's consider for a moment. And this is what I find fascinating. We have four characters. Vashti and Shaul, category one. Category two, Esther and David. And what becomes of them? Vashti, what becomes of Vashti?
She's killed off.
not much becomes of Vashti, right? She gets her little dying scene, and that's it. Perek Aleph, gone, right? And Perek Bet, Vashti's forgotten. Come on. We come to, we'll see, that's an exaggeration, but essentially, Vashti certainly does not have a major positive, you know, her biggest contribution to to God's plan in the world is that she's gotten rid of and makes room for Esther. Shaul, right? Malchut l'shai, loses the malchut, it's a temporary malchut, it's a transitional malchut. Shaul, never, it's never the story, there's no sefer Shaul, there's no part of a sefer that's the story of Shaul. Shaul's always in the shadow of Shmuel or David, and that's it. Shaul never becomes a significant character in his own right. Esther is the opposite of that, right? It's Megillat Esther. Esther says, Gemara Megillah, right, where Esther says, Kitvuni l'dorot. And indeed, the story of Esther, right, our kids are still dressing up as Esther, right? Thousands of years, the story of Esther, it remains as a, you know, key player to this day. And David HaMelech, right, establishes Malchut at Sof HaDorot. David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. No, this is what we find about these four characters. Isn't it fascinating? Davka, those people who were looking over their shoulder, who were concerned about how people would look at them, who were concerned about the impression they were making, who were concerned about their popularity rating, concerned about how other people were looking at them, what happened to them, they end up in the long run making no impression. And Davka, those people who said, I'm not so worried about what they're thinking. I'm not so worried about how they look at it. That's not the issue. The issue is, what am I doing? Who am I? Those are the people who made an internal an eternal impression on the pages of history, and certainly of Jewish history. And I don't think that's coincidental. And so I want to conclude with the following observation, with the following perspective. And partly out of all the sources we've seen, and partly out of just a little bit of life experience. In terms of what you see, whether it's in everyday life, just in, you know, people around you, whether it's what you see in terms of the pages of history, of Tanakh, whatever aspect of life, whatever prism you're going to look at it through, one thing is very clear, that a person who is, again, no one is either entirely one or the other, right? We all have elements of both. But to the degree that we can be more David and Esther-like than Shaul and Vashti-like, to the degree that we can be more in the mold of David and Esther, that we can be Ru'uta or Re'acha, right? Atov or Atova, as the case may be, to that degree, number one, we're going to accomplish a lot more in life. We're going to be much more effective in doing the right thing, in accomplishing good things, in accomplishing great things. If we're looking over our shoulder and being concerned, do people approve? How does it look to other people? What are they thinking? What are they thinking? It's actually the first thing that the Torah talks about in Or HaChaim is this idea, right? That person has to have a certain toughness to be able to say, I have to do the right thing, and people make fun or look down or this, that, and the other, they don't approve, that's their problem. One of the most fundamental things, when the tour begins, all of Shulchan Aruch, right, the first thing they discuss is this idea. He says it's fundamental to all of Torah. Very basic idea, that we can't accomplish what we ought to in life if we're overly concerned about what other people think and what other people approve of or don't approve of, or they like it, don't like it. It's the number one recipe for not accomplishing anything in life. But number two, if I can add parenthetically, that's the point number one is what comes out of these sources, if I add parenthetically, it also has a major impact on how happy we are, on our quality of life as well. Because the more you see, the more you realize that no matter what you do, everyone's not going to approve. And if people, you know, popularity and approval are very, very ethereal, they don't last very long. Approve one moment, it's very fickle. And if you're trying to get other people's approval, it's like chasing a shadow. It just doesn't work. People who, their sense of self, their sense of accomplishment, their sense of being okay, it's based on other people's approval and things of that nature, it's really a recipe for failure. And I can't tell you how many times I've had this discussion with other people. So many times where, I mean, it happens to be that over the last several decades I've been involved primarily in the world of chinuch. So I'm going to give you an example from there. It's lav davka about that, but it just happens to be that that's where it's come up the most, just because, you know, that's where I interact with people the most. And, you know, Baruch Hashem, at this stage, I have lots and lots of old Talmidim who are now, you know, mechanchim themselves in all kinds of different places and contexts. So we get to talk to people about these things. It is the most common thing that you have a following discussion with someone. They talk about the fact that, you know, they're in this job, they're teaching in a certain place, and it's very difficult. It's very difficult emotionally because the person who they're, you know, supposedly working for, the principal or the Rosh Hashiva or the this or the that, whatever, you know, the you know. Very commonly you find in a lot of places, and I have to tell you, I'm not speaking about myself because Baruch Hashem, I've, you know, been very fortunate. I'm really not talking about my own experiences, but I'm talking about experiences and talking to people who've had this experience many, many times. Very often you have a situation where people who are in charge, people who are the boss or whatever, very often they will let you know if there's something wrong. But if everything's great, they won't talk to you. You know, I mean, they won't say good morning, but they won't talk to you about how you're doing or what they think or whatever. And there's, you know, and some people, I know the people who come to me and said, it's so depressing. You know, like, I feel like, you know, I never get, you know, any kind of, you know, positive feedback, and it's very difficult. And I try to tell them that if you're going to, you know, be focused on whether you're getting, you know, a pat on the back or whatever from your boss or from your super, whatever it is, you're always going to be miserable because it's never going to be good. You can't be like that. You can't be worried about what this person's thinking, what that person's thinking. Does he approve? Doesn't he approve? You have to know yourself. Your standard of success has to be, am I teaching them? Am I giving them something important? Am I helping them? Are they getting something out of it? Do I feel like, the job is about teaching the Talmidim. It's not about the, you know, your work is in terms of your students. It's not in terms of the administrator, whatever it is. So again, that's an example, just something that, you know, a lot of Talmidim who are teachers, so this has come up many times. Friends, relatives, whatever. But it applies in any realm of life. That if that's where we're going to get our sense of being okay or not, it's a recipe for disaster. On the other hand, if we're focused on, am I doing a good job? Am I contributing? Am I doing something worthwhile? You know, on the real issues, on the thing itself and not how others perceive it, then it's possible not only to accomplish infinitely more, better things, greater things, but at the same time to also have a much better quality of life. And that's why I think that this particular analysis of Ruta Tova Mimena, we've really, you notice we've been talking about one little phrase, half and a third of a pasuk this whole time. So you didn't believe it would happen, right? But sure enough, we've been talking about this pasuk the entire time, trying to understand this one phrase. But I think that it's so important and so meaningful because I believe that really this is an issue and a matter of perspective which can affect the quality and productivity of our lives in the most significant way, more than most other things. This is just such a key issue in what kind of a life we're going to have. And that's why I want to spend a few minutes discussing this phrase of Malchutai Tanamelech, Luruta Tova Mimena. I think it's rather, rather important to each and every one of us. Ezra Hashem, next time we'll discuss another aspect of the Megillah, which is also very, very important, but a very different type of different perspective that also in the Megillah, as I said, because there's such important things in the Megillah, and who knows who's going to still be here at Purim time or not. People haven't decided, half a year, a whole year, you know, engaged, married, not, who knows what's going to happen between now and then. So, you know, we have to make sure that certain things we get to before, yes, hit this one. Okay.